This is the takeaway for July 29th.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Today, a look at things that were once of spectacular significance that have been transformed by time. How time has changed our view of prison and prison reform in the United States, and the political significance of all of that. And how time has transformed convicted spy Jonathan Pollard from a mentally unstable turncoat back in the 1980s to something of a hero in Israel today. And we shall see how Pollard, once released later this year, may change again in the minds of Israelis and Americans. The cross-country journey, once a defining rite of passage for every American, now more often encountered in literature. How a map and road stories are being combined online to get people back on the road this summer. But we begin with a character who was unknown to Americans until the 9/11 attacks in 2001, when he was seen as the number two to Osama bin Laden, the man who protected the al-Qaeda leader for years and who continued as spiritual leader to the Taliban until his reported death was announced by the Afghan government and security sources this week. Mullah Omar survived the $10 million U.S. bounty on his head, but was not in the best of health. He has been out of the public eye for years and would leave a strong Taliban behind him, but one looking toward ISIS in Iraq and Syria for the next chapter in the jihadist movement. Joining me now with more is Sami Yousafzai, Newsweek and Daily Beast correspondent in Pakistan and Afghanistan. He's covered al-Qaeda and the Taliban since September 11th. He says that Omar's shadowy, reclusive style did not prevent him from having significant influence.
Well, although he was not very obvious, and he was very deeply underground right after the collapse of the Taliban, most of the Taliban fighters considered Mullah Omar as a spiritual leader, is a very honest leader, and one of the reasons the Taliban remained very much united since 1994 was the leadership of Mullah Omar, and he was very believed to everyone. And I think although he was not very much active, he was not chairing any Taliban big meeting, he was underground, but still he was a big name in support for the Taliban unity and the Taliban fighters.
And how careful was he in terms of guarding his identity and keeping virtually everything about him secret?
Well, since nobody knew, even if I could meet Mullah Omar and travel in a car with him, since nobody really had seen him, and I think probably 200 people among the Taliban had were able to see Mullah Omar. So I think it was easy for him. But I think since he was a countryside villager and he was not relying on modern technology, and one of the reasons he was very successfully hiding for years, his keep himself away from the mobile telephone and internet.
He was responsible for really centering power in Afghanistan away from Kabul for a while in Kandahar. Has that still been the case? Is Kandahar remaining a jihad power center in Afghanistan? And is that a legacy of Mullah Omar?
Well, I would say nowadays some parts of the Kandahar is peaceful if we compare with the other parts of the Afghanistan. So I think at the moment I would not say it's only a Kandahar insurgency, and it's a nationwide Taliban insurgency. And especially after the withdrawal of the American and NATO forces, they are now more active and more in control.
If Mullah Omar is no longer leading the Taliban, where will Taliban fighters go? Will they stay in Afghanistan and fight the current government, or will they look for other opportunities?
The problem is this is an ideological fighting for Taliban, and they think this is jihad. This is something related to religion, and they were not fighting for Mullah Omar. They think they were fighting for God, and God will be forever. So I don't think so. They will give up their weapons if Mullah Omar is died, because Mullah Omar was a spiritual and a religion leader. So I don't think so that will have a very negative impact on the insurgency. But of course, it will have a negative impact on ongoing peace talks, because most of the people believe that United Taliban has a better chance for a negotiation. If some small groups of Taliban splits from Taliban, they will be more hardliner.
As the center of the jihad movement in the Middle East and South Asia shifted to ISIS, what was Mullah Omar's reaction to all of that?
Well, I think the Taliban don't believe that ISIS would be a big threat for them. First of all, Afghan society is a very traditional Sunni society, They don't like Wahhabis type of people, and ISIS are mostly Wahhabi and Ahli Hadith. Second, we don't have any Wahhabi population in Afghanistan. And third, we are not Arab. And fourth reason, there is no good opportunity for ISIS to grow up in Afghanistan. We don't have any anti-Shia sentiments in Afghanistan. And I don't think so that ISIS will be a big challenge. But definitely we are hearing that the Taliban issued statements and ordered their fighter to fight against anyone who is becoming loyal to ISIS or Sheikh al-Baghdadi. That's why recently some part of the Afghanistan, Taliban had a successful crackdown against the ISIS, and they are almost kicked out from the areas where they have been operating since last 6 months.
Sami, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Sami Yousafzai is Newsweek and Daily Beast correspondent in Pakistan and Afghanistan. He spoke with us from London. When Jonathan Pollard was caught spying for Israel in the 1980s, it was a shocker for a relationship that was traditionally close but beginning to feel real strains. Pollard described his motives in an Israeli TV interview in the 1990s.
My motives may have been well and good, but they only serve to explain why I did what I did. They certainly do not serve as an excuse for breaking the law.
This week, nearly 30 years after Pollard's arrest, a federal panel announced that Pollard will be released on parole on November 21st of this year. In the time of his captivity, Pollard has undergone a remarkable transformation that mirrors significant changes in Israel and the United States. Chemi Shalev is U.S. correspondent for Haaretz newspaper. He says Pollard's release could make the relationship between Israel and the United States even more complicated.
In Israel, there's been an evolution throughout the 3 decades that he's been in jail. In the beginning, there was a sort of embarrassment, and people kept their distance, and the government kept their distance. But then, as time went by, and with the rise of the political right wing in Israel, he turned into some kind of hero for people who viewed him as someone who had done things for the benefit of Israel. And he also came to symbolize, and I think this is probably one of his most potent aspects, is that he came to symbolize the resistance to an American government that was either callous or, in fact, harbored anti-Israeli intentions. And therefore, he became a hero mainly of the right wing in Israel and in between the inside the right wing, especially of the settler movement.
Is he consistent with that mythology? I mean, is he that kind of a hero, or is he more of a character who just wanted to kind of run off and join the circus and have some excitement?
You know, there are two Jonathan Pollards. There's a Jonathan Pollard that you get from American investigators and from a lot of the court documents in which he was a sort of not completely stable character, not a completely judicious character who tried to sell secrets to other countries and not only to Israel, and who then was completely foolhardy in the amount of secrets that he sort of carted away from the naval intelligence in which he worked. If you read the Israeli version, or at least Pollard's version, which has been accepted by large parts of Israel, then he is a person who was very loyal to the United States, but perhaps even more loyal to the state of Israel. And he became concerned that the United States was withholding secrets that it was supposed to be giving to Israel, or that he expected it to give Israel concerning Arab countries. And that he just, you know, he was sort of a martyring himself for the state of Israel. So there are two different versions here. And another element of that is that Israelis think that the Americans were being way too harsh and that they were singling him out for punishment, whereas if you listen to American intelligence officials, even if that's true, it's because he gave away the volume and the depth of the secrets that he gave away are unprecedented. So you have to choose between these two narratives, although I'm sure the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Will we discover the truth as Pollard comes back as a hero, or who knows how he'll be greeted? I mean, he went from being an absolutely irrelevant character as far as Israel is concerned to now being a kind of bargaining chip. That's the last narrative we would have expected.
Well, I don't know if he's a bargaining chip. There's still another chapter to be written here because according to the conditions of his parole, he has to live for 5 years in the United States, and he wants to go to Israel. And so, and in order to be able to go to Israel, the president has to give him clemency. And so from certain points of view, we're back to square one, where Israelis will be asking for clemency. And if the president refuses to give it, again, the Americans will be viewed as callous and indifferent towards Israel. It's a question. It's an open question to my mind whether he really wants to go to Israel and what will happen to him. But I have no doubt that there will be, on the one hand, he will be received as a hero. But I think that once he's released, people will sort of go back to the original case and perhaps will again begin to start feeling uneasy. And I think that will be even truer in America with American Jews. I think that while they were fighting for his release, they sort of forgot that when he was caught, it was very embarrassing for them.
Chaime Shalev, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Chaime Shalev is U.S. correspondent for the newspaper Haaretz.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills, like calculus, CPR, and celestial navigation. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
We've seen moments of personal significance and global diplomacy as the president has toured Africa these past 2 weeks. He used the opportunity to criticize religious tolerance and discrimination against women and gays. He spoke to African leaders in Addis Ababa, singling out the officials who were notably absent from the African Union Hall, including Robert Mugabe, the longtime dictator of Zimbabwe. David Smith is The Guardian's Africa correspondent. He spoke with us from Addis Ababa about the way Obama has been perceived by Kenyans, Ethiopians, and others throughout the continent.
I think Barack Obama has been on great form and certainly extremely well received in Kenya and Ethiopia during this tour. I was there to see his arrival at the international airport in Nairobi a few days ago, and he appeared with a spring in his step as he came off Air Force One, and it was kind of forward momentum from then on. There were some powerful speeches that really touched a nerve. On Saturday, he really stood up for gay rights in Africa. You might say Africa is the most homophobic continent in the world. The following day, he was equally strong on women's rights and questioning female genital mutilation in Africa. And he was very forthright about how it's wrong for leaders to cling on for power too long. And he tied that up very nicely by comparing it to himself, saying that he thinks he could probably do a good job if he had a third term as U.S. president, but it would be against the law. And all of this went down, I think, much better from Barack Obama, the son of an African, than it would have done from any other U.S. president or any other Western leader.
Is there a way to gauge how he's being received differently on the street versus among leaders who have their own agenda, often very, very different from their citizens?
You know, there was a lot of enthusiasm on the street. It was slightly hard to gauge in both countries. There was a significant security lockdown, Nairobi especially, many streets deserted. So you had to rely really on what's the media saying, what's Twitter saying. And also, in Kenya, there was a speech to about 4,500 Kenyans, including many students. And certainly everyone we talked to there was enraptured and a huge fan of Obama. So it certainly seemed as if he was hugely, hugely popular, not only with the officials he was meeting, but, within the wider population.
Would you say the enthusiasm is more related to Obama's personal story, or does the United States have a particular credibility that you can measure at this point in time? Is it just Obama, or is it Obama plus what the United States can, in theory, do for these nations?
I think it's probably predominantly Obama. Since his election in 2008, he's been a bit of a rock star in Africa. He really was the perfect guest. He played it very well. He would begin every speech with a little bit of the local language. He would constantly make references to his African heritage and its importance to him, and talk about his father coming from Kenya. All of that really scored points with the local audience. And one might say Kenya especially perhaps is the last place in the world that never became disillusioned or disappointed in the Obama presidency. That early optimism was never quite going to be fulfilled. But in Kenya, people were lining the streets 6, 7, 8 hours before Air Force One landed in the hope of a glimpse of him. Underlying that, you know, look, America has this amazing soft power around the world. Even without thinking about it, people are drinking Coca-Cola and eating McDonald's and listening to American music and often aspiring to maybe go to America one day. You know, it remains that dream for a lot of people around the world. So any American president will therefore have a certain mystique, a certain celebrity value. But there's no doubt Barack Obama will be a very hard act to follow in Africa.
Although it's been said that George W. Bush was a hard act to follow for Barack Obama in certain tangible terms, in delivering health care and certain tangible economic benefits to people in Africa. Do people have a sense of that Obama has not met expectations, that he would be at least as good as George W. Bush?
Yes, there was an interesting moment at the press conference on Saturday in Kenya, where Obama himself said that he thinks George Bush's PEPFAR program combating HIV/AIDS in Africa is one of the best things any U.S. administration has done for decades and has saved millions of lives. And, you know, he said it's not a beauty contest between presidents. This is one U.S. Government. There are certainly some in Africa who, you know, even after the lift of this visit, where I think Obama made some very powerful statements, would nevertheless say that overall, you know, it has been a bit of an anticlimax for Africa. In his first term, I think Obama only spent less than 24 hours in sub-Saharan Africa. There have been some more visits this time, and he's now visited more often than any other U.S. president. But yeah, certainly some would say there is a lack of tangible projects. Obama obviously would disagree, and he seemed quite miffed that people were questioning the Power Africa project for failing to deliver electricity as promised so far. He said, look, it's only a couple of years old, and you know, you don't build a power station overnight. So some of the real most concrete benefits of the Obama era for Africa might actually really yield results after he's left the White House.
David Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Smith covers Africa for The Guardian. The American landscape has been the source of stories since the creation myths of the Iroquois nation.
In the beginning, the daughter of the creator of Earth was impregnated by the west wind. While in the womb, her twins fought as to who would be born first. The left-handed twin refused to be born the usual way, and instead tried to force himself out of his mother's armpit.
Natives applied the first layers of story laid down in the landscape of North America, where place has always been the source of stories, stories piled upon stories, stacked high on the back of the Iroquois' turtle of creation. For all natives, the stories were the maps of the places around them. But in our time, we carry maps on our phones, and they tell us where to go, but omit the stories that might slow us down as we rush around under strict orders from GPS commands. This omission is the driver behind a project called Atlas Obscura, a map of journeys across America that commands us to slow down and take the trip of Robert Pirsig in the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, or Kerouac's book On the Road, or Tom Wolfe's book The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and many others. It's the ultimate literary website, and freelance writer Richard Kreitner is a contributor, along with mapmaker Stephen Melendez, who created the map. Richard, what do you see out there, out the window, when you travel across the country?
I see vast expanses that it's surprising to find are still one country, and refreshing to, you know, relearn that they are.
And books that go from one end of the country to the other, literary creations that are legendary, that have places associated with them that people need to see.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I've taken many road trips by myself with a bunch of these in my back pocket, and they're a great guide to the United States.
And I've got a clip that I want to play for you, because I suspect this story, this kind of crazy story, is in your anthology, right?
You're going to need plenty of legal advice before this thing is over.
Oh, yeah.
As your attorney, I advise you to rent a very fast car with no top, tape recorder for special music, a couple of go shirts. Blows my weekend. Naturally, I'm going to have to go with you. And we're going to have to arm ourselves to the teeth.
Well, why not? I mean, if things worth doing.
We're doing right.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Not on the map.
It's not on the map.
No, because I figured that the drive from L.A. to Las Vegas was too short. I was looking for kind of vast, expansive ones.
And much of the trip there was taken with substances.
Yeah, the trip is metaphysical more than geographical.
Chemical, in fact.
Yeah.
So what kinds of trips did you choose, thinking in terms of the vast expanse that was possible in North America?
Sure. Well, I wanted narratives that were kind of in the first person. So it's one person, either in fiction, like On the Road, or nonfiction, like Charles Strait's Wild, where they're describing the landscape as it kind of unfolds before them. So the Lolita, for instance, didn't make the cut because the road trip sections are not in chronological order. They're all helter-skelter. You can't map that. So I just wanted a clean narrative across the landscape where you could see, most importantly to me at least, how the different authors intersected and how they described the same place at different times in different or similar ways.
And you can read your way across the country in these narratives. You can actually hop in the vehicle or the motorcycle and go to those places and read as you go.
Exactly. Or across time as well. My favorite part is like when in Salt Lake City, you have an intersection of Mark Twain, Jack Kerouac, and Ted Conover, a journalist who rode the rails with hobos.
Sure.
And to see the different ways that they describe the mountains around Salt Lake City, to me, is like a whole history of American literature and indeed the country.
What do the intersections tell you?
They tell me that, it's in the details. It's in the way, the different ways that they describe it. So,
because the places don't change over that time, really.
Well, they do. I mean, Salt Lake City did change from the 1860s to the 1980s. And the ways in which American writers describe those changes is telling. I mean, Twain uses this illustrious, grand language to describe the mountains and the heavens. And Kerouac is describing, that's Dean Moriarty's birthplace, Salt Lake City. So he's describing Dean Moriarty emerging bedraggled many years ago. It's like a whole mid-century American thing. And then Ted Conover is describing this post-industrial landscape of factories and forgotten industry. And that says something about 1980s America.
And, in the shadow of the Mormon temples, actually.
Right.
The book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance is very much about landscape and place and not human settlements, but physical landscape and an interior story that's going on at the same time. How did you decide to choose that one?
Well, I read that one on the road many years ago as well, so it was a natural and everyone loves that book. A lot of the books and a lot of the descriptions of landscape are sort of, I'm glad you said that, are kind of descriptions of internal landscapes and emotional states. And that's also very interesting when you trace the lines across the map.
I mean, part of what I think about when I look at this project is that people don't necessarily travel across the country in the way that they used to in the 20th century.
Absolutely. This is definitely a piece of propaganda to get people to travel across the country. In the intro for the map on the website Atlas Obscura, I quote this 1865 travel book, which I think is maybe one of the first American cross-country travel books. And it's by a guy named Samuel Bowles, an old Massachusetts newspaper editor. And he says something like, "There's no such knowledge of the nation as comes from traveling its vast extent and meeting its purposeful people." And I think that that's true. And I think that many of our kind of social and political difficulties and the great assortment of people into red states and blue states or red areas and blue areas of the states has a lot to do with the fact that we see Thailand before we see Tennessee.
Hmm. When did you take your first trip across the country and how meaningful was it for you?
It was very meaningful. 10 years ago, a road trip with my dad to California. He did a lot of train travel in the 70s by himself. And then 4 years after that, I did my own first solo jaunt. And I've done that around 8 times.
Car, motorcycle?
No, I wish motorcycle.
Rails?
Mostly rails. Twice by car with my girlfriend. We did a 4-month road trip.
And you were still speaking by the end?
Yeah, still speaking today.
Still speaking today? Excellent. Richard Kreitner, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Richard Kreitner is an archivist for The Nation magazine and a freelance writer. He helped create a map of literary journeys across America for Atlas Obscura. What's your favorite story from the road?
Hi, it's Michelle from Honolulu. When I was 16 and living in Florida, my mom bought a Volkswagen camper van, and Mom, my sister, and I headed west. It was 1967. We went to Yellowstone, Cheyenne, Wyoming, Laramie. The best thing was Mom waking us up in the middle of the night one night in Yellowstone. to see a great horned owl sitting under the parking lot light at the outpost where we were camped.
This is Carolyn Scott from Austin, Texas, and my sense of adventure in Wanderlust inspired my favorite road trip. My best friend and I, after high school graduation, we commandeered my mom's minivan and went on a two-week adventure around the Southwest and got into as much trouble and had as much fun as two goofy 18-year-old girls can possibly get into.
Give us one of those stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. And here's something to take with you. In the annals of dental extraction, this story is particularly unwelcome. Reuters reports that an American hunter, a dentist from Minnesota, has killed the best-known lion in Zimbabwe, Cecil. According to the report, he paid two Zimbabwean men $50,000 to lure old Cecil out of a wildlife park where hunting is banned, and then the dentist shot Cecil with a bow and arrow. He then tracked him for 2 days before finally killing him with a gun. If you think about it, dentists aren't used to having to actually hunt around for their prey. Those root canals typically just sit right down and open their mouths and say, ah. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.